Now, you have probably heard it said before that those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. But another has said, and probably more aptly, that history never repeats itself. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. That is to say, that you are never going to have the exact same event with the exact same characters who are faced with the exact same problem, who make the exact same decision with the exact same result. It's not going to happen the same. History only happens once. But events will be similar enough as we experience them and as we see and observe them in history that it will resound like an echo throughout the corridors of history as time progresses towards its fulfillment. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. History, as we think of it, it is linear. Everyone here has a philosophy of history. There are various ideas of what history is. Is history cyclical? Are we just, an expanding and contracting universe going through one of its infinite cycles? Is it irregular, just a series of chaos, or is it purpose-driven? Is it linear? Is it progressing? Scripture teaches that history is progressing. It is a story. Not only is it a story, though, it's a story that is going somewhere. It is going towards its culmination, and it's going to finish much like it began. Look at Isaiah 65, if you have your word with you today. Isaiah 65, and I'm going to start in verse 17. Isaiah 65, 17. Listen to this. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things will not be remembered or come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing and her people for gladness. I will also rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people, and there will no longer be heard in her the voice of weeping or the sound of crying. No longer will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. For the youth will die at the age of 100, and the one who does not reach the age of 100 will be thought accursed. Was there a time when someone who died at the age of 100 would have been thought of as a youth that we've encountered? Have we experienced this before in the story? Genesis. The oldest individual lived 969 years. That was Methuselah. But back then, we have these ages. He's saying, we're going back to that time. But this isn't the eternal estate. Death is still in the world. People are still dying, people are still living, but they're living much longer. We're going back to that time. Notice verse 25. In this time, the wolf and the lamb will graze together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. Creation is going to be redeemed. It's going to be restored. The curses are going to be rolled back, even on the animals. Everything is going to be affected. But notice, and dust will be the serpent's food. They will do no evil or harm in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. The snake remains as a perpetual reminder of the Lord's defeat, his overcoming of Satan. But we're moving in a direction, we're progressing somewhere. That place is very similar to the beginning. It's not the exact same, but it's similar. That's how story works. The denouement of the story, the end of the story, the happy resolution. That's where this story is going. There will be a garden. There will be a last Adam ruling as king, representing God. There will be a serpent that enters the garden trying to deceive. But this isn't going to repeat the same way it began, because the last Adam will subdue that serpent. And then we'll move on to the eternal estate. It is the happy ending. It's where this story is progressing to. Now, I know I've said it many times, as we've been studying the grand narrative, this is a unified story. It is one story in each of the books, and each of the episodes within those books are just scenes in the story. They're like scenes in a movie. Now, we're in the book of Judges today, chapter 17, if you want to go ahead and begin getting there as we progress through this story. Now, I've mentioned before, these are scenes in a movie, so what is the context for the book of Judges? What is the necessary information that you need to know in order to accurately interpret this book? Well, the author is going to expect that you know Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. Those preceding parts of the story are absolutely essential for you to correctly interpret this part of the story. So we're interpreting Judges today. We're hopefully going to be closing and finishing this terrible account of Israel's moral decline in the land today. And we're starting in chapter 17. Just to give you a quick review, to get to this point, remember, God has made a promise not just to redeem the world through the seed of the woman. That seed of the woman is coming through a nation. Genesis chapter 12, God singled out Abraham and told him he was going to make him into a nation, and in him, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Now, in order to turn this man who had a barren wife into a nation, he had to give them a son, multiply that son and his descendants into a people. Okay? This people was in bondage to a Gentile nation when God formed them into a nation. So he had to redeem them from that nation, the book of Exodus. He had to deliver them. Once they were delivered, he had to provide them with his law so that they would know, how can we represent God in truth? God reveals to them his character and his desire by giving them his word, that is the law. He also gives them his special dwelling. He dwells amongst this people, separating them from all the other nations of the earth. This is the people that represents the Creator God, the one true God, the God who put the curse on the world, so he has the power to remove the curse, that God. They also needed a land from which they would rule and bless the other nations. And that's why they ended up in the land of Canaan. It was the land that God promised Abraham. The only thing that they are lacking by the time we end the book of Joshua is a king. Now, we know when they entered the land, they didn't remove all the inhabitants of the land like they were supposed to. And that's been a thorn in their side ever since. They've been constantly dragged into idolatry. They are worshiping these false pagan gods, and as a result, they are receiving judgment. They don't fully inhabit the land. They also are lacking a king. We know this last Adam is a king that's going to come and rule over them. In the period in between, they've had various leaders, various rulers, various offices. Those offices would be listed in Deuteronomy 16 and 17 and 18. The first office that popped up after Joshua died is the office of judge. And that judge was supposed to restrain Israel from evil, to lead Israel to obedience to the Lord, to deliver Israel and subject the nations that were oppressing Israel. They were supposed to remove that threat. And as we've walked through this book of the Judges, we've seen them gradually decline and decline and decline in their ability to lead the people to follow the Lord in righteousness. We started with Othniel, and Othniel was Caleb's brother, right? And he was righteous. He followed the Lord fully. Ehud was okay. But then by the time we get to Deborah and Barak, we're saying, well, I'm not even sure what's going on now or how to interpret. The officers are not doing their job, and Deborah is leading the people. And then when we watch Gideon, who follows that, well Gideon, although he does have some faith, you know, he's not going to go and remove those idols in broad daylight. He's going to do it at nighttime. But he does follow the Lord enough to get them removed from Gentile subjection. Then he wants to try to play the king without the title. Saying, okay, you know what's going on with Gideon. Well, then we see Jephthah, this bandit who's placed as a leader, and he's making rash vows and doing incorporated pagan sacrifice unwittingly, in some degree, in their worship of God. And then there's Samson. And Samson, we're having trouble finding north throughout the whole story. I don't even know what this guy is doing. I know what he's supposed to be doing, but he's just tippy-toeing around breaking the law at every single point in the story. The question then is, we've come and we've chronicled these judges and chronicled the decline. Why in the world was it necessary to go through 16 chapters of that? Why didn't the author just say, as he does repeatedly, that Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord? Why? Because this is a story. And that's not how story operates. Story piles it on. All right, I think about my conversations with my wife. I'm a guy. I'm to the point. Most of us are. You know, if you hear two guys talking on the telephone, it's probably bam, bam, bam. They get to the point and that's it. She's come home and she asked me how my day was. My day was great. That's the extent of it. But ladies, I think that y'all are better at telling stories. You're more, or at least my wife is, she's more inclined to stories. So if I ask her, how was her day? She doesn't just say that it was great. She's going to say, well, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. She is walking me through it so that I am experiencing her day with her, and I have a better understanding of what she means, that her day was good. I am experiencing that. And that's what the author is doing with us in the book of Judges. He wants you to experience this desperation. We're looking for a Messiah to come. But things aren't getting better. It doesn't look like he's popping up anywhere in the near future. In fact, things are getting much worse. He's going to say, no. Now, you thought the judges were bad. We're done with them now. How are the next officers going to do? That's where we're turning to. The priests. How are the priests doing in the land? And the last five chapters in the book of Judges are going to address that issue. How are the priests doing in the land? So if you look at chapter 17 of the book of Judges, we're going to pick up today in verse 1. Chapter 17, verse 1. There was a man in the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me, I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Well, how do we interpret this? I mean, what is going on here? I mean, you look at it and you think, all right, well, the mother had her money stolen and she issues a curse out. The son feels guilty because a curse is placed upon him. So he confesses and he returns the money. You think, well, that's good. Well, the mother then goes on to bless him and then commit. She makes a vow to take that money, perhaps in order to counteract this curse with which she's cursed her son, and build a graven image to worship God with. And we think, apart from knowing anything about the law, we think, well, that seems like a good thing, like she's wanting to offer praise to the Lord, and she's happy that her son has become repentant. But because we know the law, we know, no, this is not good. She's going about this in entirely the wrong way. She's just made a vow to break the law. But it gets worse. Not only does she make a vow to break the law, she manages to break her vow and then keep her vow kind of at the same time. She doesn't give the 1,100 that she swore to the Lord to make a molten image. She gives 200, but she still makes the molten image. And then we have Micah, this thief, consecrate his son as a... I mean, it's just, it's a wreck. It's a train wreck. But you know that because you know the story. This is not an acceptable means of worship. This is not an acceptable means of behavior. This is pagan. This is pagan. But the story is going to go on. When we come to the following verses, we're introduced to a Levite. It's like, well, we know that he made some random guy a priest. You know that's not supposed to be the case. So here's a real Levite. Here's what's going on. And the Levite is from Bethlehem. He's traveling to the hill country in Ephraim where Micah happens to live. And he comes across Micah. He comes across his house. Micah recognizes him as a Levite and says, how about I pay you to live with me and you can be my personal priest? Thinking that if I actually have a Levite as my priest, then I'll have the favor of the Lord. Sounds a little contemporary, doesn't it? If a powerful, influential individual can get someone who is leading the religious community to be on their side, to endorse them, then they'll be accepted. Then the Lord will accept them, then the people will accept them. Of course, we know the Levite had no business even being in the hill country of Ephraim. They're supposed to be serving with the tabernacle, but this individual does. And we see it just begins from here. What started off as a simple enough proposition is going to end up leading an entire tribe into idolatry. Chapter 18, look at verse 1. In those days, once again, it's like the author's apology as we go through. This is mentioned four times in these five chapters. He's like, let me tell you what they're doing, okay? And he lists something terrible, and then it's like he turns around to apologize. You got to remember, in those days, there was no king in Israel. People were doing what was right in their own eyes, okay? Then he goes on. That's what he says. There's no king in Israel in those days. And in those days, the tribe of Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in. For until that day, an inheritance, it could read, has not been allotted to them. It could read, for until that day, it, their allotment, had not fallen to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. Now, had Dan been allotted, had they been told what land was theirs at this point? It's important to note that these stories are not necessarily chronological. These are happening amidst the judges. They're overlapping. The author's intention was just to tell you, hey, this is how ridiculous the judges were. And he goes through that. Now he's doing the same thing with the Levites. But this is overlapping. This is happening at the same time period. So the question is, did Dan know where they were supposed to dwell? Well, we're told at the very beginning, before Joshua even died, that they did. This is in chapter 1, verse 34. As Israel is going out and the various tribes are failing one after another to completely subdue the inhabitants of the land, Dan is perhaps the worst of the bunch. The Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country of Ephraim, perhaps, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites persisted in living in Horeb. Now, Dan's property had a lot of Philistines as well. They had some fierce people in the land, fierce people with military power such as chariots. But nonetheless, Dan is unable to take possession. And that's where we find them in chapter 18. They still haven't taken possession, so they're going to start looking for new land. That's the solution. This land is supposed to be ours, but we're not strong enough to take it. So we're going to start sending out spies. We're looking for a new location. And they do. They send out spies, and the spies just so happen to come across Micah's house. And they recognize the Levite there because of his accent. He has an accent, and they recognize, you are a Levite. So they decide to inquire to the Levite in verse 5. They say, inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we're going will be prosperous. They're asking him, will it be prosperous for us to utterly disregard the command of the Lord and settle somewhere else in Israel? You tell us, priest. The priest responds in verse 6, go in peace. Your way in which you're going has the Lord's approval. I mean, what do I know? I'm a priest who's serving in the hill country of Ephraim. The Lord has blessed me clearly for disobeying him. Sure, he'll bless you too. He's given me money. He's given me a place to live. He's fed me. Things are good here. It'll go well for you as well. Do what's right in your eyes. And they do. They go and they find a people that are not well defended. A people in a lush land that don't have large armies or fortifications. And they report back to the tribe. They say, we found an easier place. We need to go and take it. So they mount up their army and they go. But on their way, where are they going to stop at? Micah's house. And they're going to bring the priest with them. And they're going to bring the molten idols with them. And they're going to set him up as a perpetual priesthood in the tribe of Dan. And we find the outcome. It's the shocker of the story in chapter 18. Look at verse 30. They go, they conquer the city, they take this land, they settle in this land in rebellion against the Lord. Then the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of, and your text probably says Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. Now, what's interesting, the reason this is such a shocker is Jonathan, the son of Gershom, is not the son of Manasseh. In the manuscript, in the text, there is a little addition. In Hebrew, there was no vowels. They're all consonants. And there's a little addition. It is the N sound that's added to this word to make it Manasseh. And it's above the word because it couldn't be inserted within the word. It's sitting on top. A scribal addition said, let me fix that. They must have meant Manasseh. You know what the name becomes when you don't add that in? Moses. It wasn't Manasseh's grandson. It was Moses. Moses, the former leader of the people. His grandson is now the pagan leader of the rebellion in Dan. Now it was added because it was too shocking. They wouldn't want Moses' name dragged through the dirt like that. But that's the point of the author's intention in Judges. Saying it's so bad that Moses' descendants are now leading a pagan priesthood outside of the tabernacle. Thus chapter 18 ends. And we are introduced to another Levite, and this is the section where I'd like to pay a little of our time today as we study. This certain Levite, he also happens to reside in the hill country at Ephraim. He also has ties to Bethlehem. I mean, that's where his concubine is from. Figure that one out. He has trouble with his concubine. He has to go and chase her back down in Bethlehem. And, you know, he spends some time there. The father welcomes him. Apparently he's okay that his daughter has been made into somewhat of a prostitute. And as he's leaving, we're going to pick up our story. Look at chapter 19, verse 10. Chapter 19, verse 10. The man, this Levite, was not willing to spend the night again with his father-in-law. So he arose, and he departed, and he came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And there were with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. Okay, Jebus. Who lives in Jebus? Jebusites. So we're starting the story. He's heading back. We see, okay, Jebus, we recognize that's not supposed to be there. But he passes. He continues on. And as he's progressing and the sun is going down, he needs to find a place to stay. And his servant advises his master, why don't we turn into the city of the Jebusites? Let's go stay there. The master responds, no, no. Look at verse 12. We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel. We will go on as far as Gibeah. He said to his servant, come and let us approach one of these places and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah. So he says, no, no, we're not staying with pagans. We're staying with our people. He approaches Gibeah, and when he comes to the city, they settle in the square. They settle in the square because no one in the city will take them into the house. The square would be the most well-lit place in the city. It would have been the most traveled place in the city. Therefore, it is the safest place in the city. He settles down with his concubine, his servant, with his donkey. They settle there. And as they're preparing to spend the night, another character is introduced, an old man who happens to be from the hill country of Ephraim, who's staying in Jebus for a while. He's a foreigner sojourning in the land. He passes and he says, what are you guys doing in this square? Where are you from and where are you going? And they relate with one another a little bit. He says, look, I'm going back to Ephraim. He says, well, you can't stay in the square. You need to come stay with me. I'll take care of you. Just don't stay out here. Look at it, verse 20. Peace be to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square. Is this story sounding familiar at all at this point? Have we read something like this before? Does anyone remember something like that? Maybe Genesis? Story of Sodom and Gomorrah? The author's setting us up in the story again. We've seen it, and we know how it's supposed to play out if you remember the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The author is expecting us to look at this story and to judge it based on the previous story. We're supposed to line up the characters and then evaluate them on how well they do. So who are the main characters in Sodom and Gomorrah? Who are the ones we can think of? Lot. Okay, we got Lot. Who else? Well, he does have them. Who are the main ones running the show in the story? Lot is certainly the main ones. Who does Lot come into contact with? The angels, right? Who else is the big main character? We'd say it'd be the Sodomites, right? We got Lot, we got the angels, we got the Sodomites. Now, for us to understand this, we need to understand what roles these characters are going to be playing. So if we're looking at Judges 19 and we're casting roles for a movie, what role is the old man going to play in Sodom and Gomorrah? What role?
Lot.
Lot. Okay. What role will the Gibeahites, who are actually Benjamites, what role are they playing? They're going to be Sodomites. And what role is the Levite playing? He's the angels. So we have our characters. We have our roles. And we're going to watch and see how they fulfill those roles. How well do they do at replaying this scene? Look at verse 22. He calls the men, the old man comes, he calls the Levite into his house, stay out of the square. Verse 22, while they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows surrounded the house, pounding the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him. And then the man, the owner of the house, he went out to them and said to them, no, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out to you that you may ravish them and do whatever is good in your sight. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man. How are we doing so far? Pretty good, right? We'd say that the old man is acting just like Lot. The Benjamites are looking just like the Sodomites. Don't really see much difference. But the question is, what's supposed to happen next? What happens next in the story? Turn to Genesis 19. Hold your place here. And let's look and see how the story plays out in Genesis 19. Genesis 19, and we'll be starting in verse 4. Genesis 19, verse 4. Lot has taken the angels, they're in his house, he's fed them. In verse 4 it says, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him. And he said, please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with a man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever is good in your sight. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch they have come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien. Already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. They struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. Now, skip down a little ways. Look at verse 15. We'll go ahead and continue on. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away in the punishment, the destruction of the city. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hands and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out. They put him outside of the city. Okay. Turn back to Judges. So this is the part where the Levite, the official, the representative, God's representative in Israel, plays the part of the deliverer. Okay? He plays the part of the one with divine revelation who delivers this old man. But look what happens. Pick it up. Chapter 19. Verse 24, I'll start again. Here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out to you that you may ravish them. Do whatever is good in your sight. But do not commit such an act of folly against the man. But the men would not listen to him. So the man, that is the Levite, seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. So the angels, they seize Lot and they pull him in. They deliver him. The Levite seizes his concubine and delivers her to the men for her destruction. Polar opposites. The Levite is not performing his job. Furthermore, verse 26, as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until daylight. And when her master arose in the morning and he opened the doors of the house and he went out to go his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Up, let us go." But there was no answer. And he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and he went to his home. So, as opposed to the end, when the angels, they are seizing Lot, they say, "Up, it's time to get out of this city before the Lord's destruction comes," and they seize their hand and drag him out of the city. The Levite returns to see how his judgment played out. His concubine, we find, she's dead. We'll find a little bit later. She's dead on the threshold. He commands her, "Up, let's go." She doesn't, so he places her on his donkey and they leave. Now, what did the angels, what did the angels do to the men of Sodom? What's supposed to happen in this story? They brought Lot in and then they struck him, right? So we recognize the men of Gibeah, the Benjamites, they deserve to be struck. The Levite's not fulfilling his role. God's going to have to step in and make sure that takes place. But the author's point, remember, right now in chapters 17 through 21, we're saying the Levites, they're not doing a good job either. They're failing. In fact, their failure is worse than the judges because the results of their failure have bigger ramifications. Now notice what this Levite does. He takes the concubine, verse 29, and when he enters his house, he takes a knife, he lays hold of his concubine, and he cuts her into 12 pieces, limb by limb. He sends her out throughout the territory of Israel, and whoever saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it and take counsel." So, whenever the Levite gets back, do you remember how this government is supposed to work? Right now there's a high priest. There is a standard for how we're supposed to handle court cases. And certainly the men of Gibeah, the Benjamites, they deserve to be struck. That's clear. But what the Levite does, instead of following the proper procedures of law, as according to God's word, is he gathers all the people. He cuts his concubine up and sends word out to all the tribes and assembles them so that he can have a people's court. He's going to defer, the Levite will defer judgment to the people. God's government will be turned on its head. He's going to say, "You tell me, render your verdict. What should we do since this atrocity has happened?" Now the reason he does that is because he's a malicious witness. Now, it's on the witness of two or three that someone will be condemned. If you only have one witness, you have to be placed under scrutiny. The judge has to come before the Lord and determine whether or not your case is, you know, in the will of the Lord, or whether you are intending to produce harm on the parties. Now, the party's deserving, but the Levite is also deserving. He delivered his concubine to them to be destroyed. He didn't show sacrificial mercy. He was preserving himself. So when the people comes and he gives them his testimony, he leaves out the fact that he was partly culpable, that he was responsible. He just tells them what they did. Listen to it. Verse 4 of chapter 20. "I came with my concubine to spend the night at Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, and instead they ravished my concubine so that she died." And then yada, yada, yada. "This is what I did because of their disgraceful act. They came, they took her." So he stirs up the people. He gathers a people's court. He stirs them up. And they assemble an army and they decide, we must answer this atrocity. We can't allow, I mean, Israel's pagan, but this is just unbelievable. Even the pagan people in Israel can't allow this level of sin to take place. So they gather, they assemble, they surround Gibeah, and they call out to the inhabitants of Gibeah, those that tribe of Benjamin, and they ask them to deliver the wicked men to them so that they may punish them. Deliver to us the ones within you. But you know what Gibeah does? Say, no. No. Unlike the Levite, the men of Gibeah will not deliver these people who are deserving of judgment from them. So what results is a war. And in this part, I know our time is limited. What's going to happen as this story plays out is the author is going to start reminiscing in other parts of the story that you remember. Israel is going to gather up as an army. They're going to request of the Lord, Lord, who should go up against them? Should we do this? The Lord will say, yes, go up against them. They go, and then Gibeah wins. The Benjamites slay them. So they come back and they cry to the Lord, Lord, what's going on? Why is this happening? Should we go up against Gibeah again? Yes, go. They go. They lose again. So they're back on their knees against the Lord. Is this sounding familiar? You remember the battle of Ai right after Jericho? Joshua's people, they move in, they have a victory over Jericho, but somebody doesn't follow the Lord. He steals from the stuff that has been within the city. He takes some items for himself and he buries it in his camp. And because they don't follow the covenant, the Lord doesn't give them the victory. Joshua's complaining, Lord, why'd you bring us out here just to slay us? He says, go back. And they go back, and ultimately, they lay out an ambush, and they have victory over Ai. In the same way, we find it here, the tribe of Israel goes, they set out an ambush the third time, lead the people of Gibeah out, go and just like in the battle of Ai, they attack the city. The city's going up in smoke by the end of the story, and they wipe out Benjamin so bad that there's only 600 men left in the tribe. They've almost annihilated an entire tribe from the sons of Israel because of this Levite. What's worse is, by the end of this story, unlike, you know, in Joshua, we're coming in and the cities of the Gentiles are going up in smoke. Now we have civil war and the cities of Israel are going up in smoke. They've made a rash vow by the end of the story. They have vowed, look at it, chapter 21. The men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage. None of us, we won't allow any of our tribes, we'll be under a curse if we give our daughters to Benjamin in marriage. So you have this tribe who's been almost wiped out and it has no way to populate itself because they've made a rash vow. And as a result, verse 2, the people came to Bethel. They sat before God until evening. They lifted up their voices and they wept, saying, why, O Lord God of Israel, why has this come about in Israel so that one of the tribes should be missing today in Israel? The people's judgment resulted in almost wiping out one of the entire tribes. So as the story ends, they come up with a clever solution. The solution is, we notice that there is a feast that takes place to the Lord between Bethel and Shechem. Do we remember any stories that happen? A lot of stuff happens around Shechem, but there's one in particular. Remember Dinah? Shechem, whom the city is named after, was a prince who found Jacob's daughter, Dinah, to be attractive, and he wanted to marry her. So he took her by force, and he laid with her by force. And then he's trying to get Jacob to allow him to marry her. That's when Simeon and Levi, angry because their sister has been violated, use circumcision to wipe out the city. And as a result, they're passed over in Jacob's blessing to be progenitors of the seed of the woman. Well, here we have their solution. Not, they wipe out a people and provide them some wives, but it's not enough. So what they decide to do is during this feast that occurs between Bethel and Shechem, when any of our daughters are out there and they're dancing and they're celebrating at this feast, you can go and capture them and take them for yourselves. And we won't be culpable because we didn't technically give them to you, but basically you're all doing this wicked act. You're going and you're stealing our daughters and you're making them your wives. And of course, the story ends. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. What's interesting about that phrase is it may have been added a little bit later. And you know, earlier in chapter 18, verse 30, I mentioned that Moses had that little N added so that it wouldn't be really make him look as bad or be as shocking. But as that ends, as that verse ends, we're told that that particular pagan priesthood lasted until the captivity, which means there's been some redaction, some editorial marks, because this is someone from the captivity who's inserting that. This happens from time to time. You'll have cities' names be updated because they may realize, oh, if somebody's reading the story, they won't have any idea what city this is because it has the old name, not the new name. So we're going to put the new name in here so you can follow the story. In the same way, this guy's saying, by the way, this pagan tribe, this pagan priesthood that was set up, it stayed all the way until we went after the kings into exile. What was their situation when they went into exile? There was no king in Israel. So it may be the case that this redactor is using history as a highlighter, saying, remember, there's no king, there's no king, there's no king, and this is the direction the people were coming. We have no king. Do not let history repeat itself. Don't go into idolatry, which is ultimately cured by that captivity. And interestingly enough, not only is it highlighting that fact, but it's highlighting the story. Because what happens in 1 Samuel? We're introduced to the king. And we're saying, finally, I'm looking for a king, no king, no king, no king, king. A Benjamite, of all people, Saul, Benjamite, right after Gibeah. But that's the story. So what's the point? Why is this included? Why are we studying this today? Because it's a story. It is part of the story. It's not just a moral lesson to look at and say, well, God has told us through his law that we ought not to make rash vows or take concubines or do this or that. He's told you directly, don't do that. You know, a story doesn't really change things. I could make up a story and make it have whatever ending. I could tell you, if I wanted you to wear your seatbelt, I could tell a story about a guy who had a wreck and the seatbelt saved his life. If I want you not to wear your seatbelt, I could tell a story about a guy who had a wreck and not having a seatbelt saved his life. Story doesn't really prove anything in that way. God has given his moral imperative. He's giving the story so that you can follow through as you're watching God's progression through history towards his Messiah. That's what this is about. The fact that there is no king, there is no one who is representing God in Israel. No one. It's leading towards that depression. It's leading towards that need. They are recognizing we need the Messiah, and he's not here yet. Now, your life is a story. You're part of a narrative, but your life individually is also a story, right? It's linear. It's going somewhere. You're going in a direction, but the question is, where is your story going? Where is it heading, and how do you interpret it? What are the rules of interpretation in your story? Our story, although it's part of his story, is also interpreted through his story, right? We're reading about individuals in here. We're reading about the Micah who stole from his mother and then ultimately ends up setting up a pagan priesthood. We're interpreting that, but it's by God's character. It's by his law. As we study God's character, we have a better understanding of where we relate, how to relate to him, and how to relate to others on the basis of his character. If nothing else, you definitely know God is a patient God. He is a patient, patient God. A patient God, a loving God, and a God who has reached into history and incarnated himself in history in order to save us who are rebellious. Now we know history's coming to a close. We have the benefit of being on this side of the Messiah. We know his name. But he's not here right now. He's in heaven at the right hand of God interceding for us as our Melchizedekian priest. But he is coming.